All right, hey everybody, I'm Julie and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Julie.
And welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the Napa Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our individual stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in our lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. We hope that our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. All right, I get the pleasure of introducing our speaker tonight. I've known Maggie, I've been trying to figure it out, more than a year. We don't know how much more than a year, but not quite 2 years. And I just feel like I've known her for a really, really long time. And, you know, I think what I really like most about her is that she's so opposite of me. You know, she's very calm and wise, you know. But she's not one of those wise, calm, wise people that you don't really want to be around because they make you feel bad about yourself, you know. They're like so wise, you're like, oh man, that's too wise for me. But she's not like that at all because she has a sense of humor and she laughs at herself. And so she's one of those calm, wise people that has a way of explaining this program as it relates to her so well that it relates to me, too. So with that, I give you Maggie.
Hey, everybody. I'm Maggie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
My sobriety date is May 28th, 1994. So I have been sober for 20 years. I'm 37, pushing 38. So I got sober on the young side. So all this starts beginning. I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I had an older sister and my mom and my dad, and I had a pretty typical good childhood. You know, I went to a little private girls' school. I played sports. My sister was really good to me. My parents were really good parents. Nobody was an alcoholic in my family. My mother drank and probably once a year got really drunk at a party, and my dad would get embarrassed and stand outside the bathroom, and the next morning I had to get her a regular Coke, and then it was a year before she did it again. So nobody was an alcoholic in my family. My mother was one of 10, and all of her brothers and sisters drank joyfully and heavily, and I enjoyed that environment quite a bit. They all smoked, they all drank, and they were so much fun. And I determined when I was young that I was going to have a ton of kids and a great life because of that. So I don't think I spent my childhood feeling like I was left out or didn't fit in. But I will say that when I got to be 15 and I decided I would try this drinking thing, I kind of realized what I was missing. Like, I felt so great after I took that first drink that I fit in better, and I felt like a lot more confident, and like people noticed me, and it was just, life was much better. After just like a part of one drink, I thought to myself, this is totally awesome and I need more right away. And so I had a great time that night, but I believe that I was an alcoholic from the very first time I drank. Because I needed more. That's my whole night was characterized by I need more until I either passed out or blacked out. But I loved it for a while. My friends were pretty good at supporting me and helping me to like find my way home and things like that. I remember the morning after my first blackout. That was kind of weird because my friends didn't really talk about that. I called somebody to tell him thanks for driving me home because the plan was that he would drive me home, and he kind of said, like, I didn't drive you home. And it was a little awkward. So I kind of had to, like, pick up the pieces and figure out what happened. And I got actually a little bit more used to that, I would say, because that was pretty early in my drinking. So I kind of got used to trying to work around situations like that and not make too big a deal out of it. But certain of my friends thought it was really funny to kind of make up things that I did and tell me because they knew I had no idea. But There were things that I did that it's funny that I didn't think they were weird at the time, because in retrospect, they were totally weird. I remember at parties, I would go around and drink the rest of people's beer. Like if I saw a can of beer, I would lift it up to see, and then I would drink it. And I sort of knew deep down that that was kind of gross and weird. But I just kind of felt like I had to do that. And so I did things like that. And I tried not to let anybody see me doing that, you know, because I kind of knew, like, I'm frugal, but that's gross. So, and let's see, I did other things that that I kind of knew were wrong, but I just didn't think about it. Like, when I first started drinking, I made a promise that I would never drink and drive, and that lasted, I don't know, 6 months. And it got to the point where there were nights when I wouldn't be able to drink if I kept to that promise, and that I couldn't have that happen. So I agreed that I would be the driver as long as my friends would let me drink, because it wasn't that they wanted to be safe, they just didn't want to get a ticket. And so we agreed to that. It was like, okay, she'll be the driver and she'll drink. So that was good. I started to get in trouble, obviously. I would come home drunk. I would not come home. I would be wearing different clothes, things like that. And right around the same time I started drinking and started drinking heavily, my mother got sick with cancer. And I'm not sure if my parents told me how serious it was or not, but if they did, I decided not to hear it. So she was actually really sick, and she had stage 4 breast cancer, and it was kind of spreading. And I kind of felt like, I'm too young for this to happen to me, so I'm going to fake like it's not. I never actually thought of my drinking as medicating. I just thought I loved it so much that I had to do it, and I just didn't think about the other things that were going on. And I got questions from some friends, like, why do you drink like that? And I said, well, I think what happened is I just like it more than other people, and so that's why it's different with me. I had a good friend who was asked by her boyfriend to not see me anymore, and I was sort of appalled and angry, and I asked her about it, and she said, well, you're a bad influence. And I started laughing because I got really good grades, and so I didn't really understand how that could be a bad influence. So anyway, I had a lot of fun, and I got into a lot of trouble, and the trouble started to pile up more and more. I went on some trips to visit colleges because I was going to go off to a lovely college, and when I went to one, the college that I actually chose to go to, which was Duke, my biggest test for whether I'd go somewhere was how much could I drink when I was visiting. So I wanted to go and drink as much as I could, and they had a lot to drink at Duke when I went there. I think it was maybe one of my worst nights ever. I knew that I was going to be too drunk and embarrassing, and I knew that I didn't want that to happen. So at one point, desperately, I actually poured out part of a drink onto the ground and almost had a seizure doing that because it was such an awful feeling. But I knew, I was like, I can't do this. And so then I kept drinking after that, so it didn't work. But that was the first time where I actually woke up and didn't know where I was. And I didn't know if I was on campus or somewhere else or whose bed I was in or if anyone else was in the bed. I just sort of opened my eyes and I thought, please let it be a girl. Who is this? Where am I sleeping? And I think actually no one else was in the bed. But nonetheless, I just thought to myself, like, this didn't work out very well. This is not what I wanted to happen. And I asked my friend, and she told me some things that happened that were not so pleasing, and so I ended up having to tell my boyfriend I had cheated on him and blah, blah, blah. So it didn't go very well. And so, of course, I chose Duke. That was the school for me. I went to some other places, too, and actually one of the schools I went to was this school in Boston, and there was no alcohol, and I couldn't believe it. It was maybe the worst night of my life because I was expecting it, and I'm like, I actually thought people were walking around with water bottles, and I thought, it must be vodka. They must have some kind of liquor in those water bottles. That's how delusional I was. And I asked somebody, and they kind of laughed at me, like they just assumed I was joking. So I was like, oh, I guess I'm wrong. Okay. But I almost called my parents to pick me up because I was so upset. And then I realized that would be hard to explain why I was so upset. So I didn't. But anyway, so let's see. I'm drinking more and more. I'm not talking to my parents. I'm sort of mad at them because they put all these rules. You know, they don't want me to get home late. They don't want me to be drunk. Very annoying. So as time went on, there was more and more friction between me and my parents, and I wasn't going to speak to them. They really wanted me to, and they basically said things that were really kind, like, you know, we're just worried about you. We just want to be close to you and know how you're doing and how you're feeling. And that made me angry, and I said, why can't you leave me the hell alone? I get straight A's, so leave me alone. So that's how that went. Halfway through my senior year in high school, my mother actually became ill to the point where she was about to die. And her brothers and sisters all came to visit, and I actually really enjoyed it because they would all drink with me. And they would even smoke pot with me. So it was, like, really, really fun. I took a couple weeks off school telling that my school that I needed to sort of mourn or whatever. And we had a really good time, me and my mom's siblings. I felt a little bit bad because I overheard my dad ask one of my uncles, can you keep her a little bit less drunk tonight because I need her to help, you know, my mother get to the bathroom. And I thought, oh, he knows that I'm drinking. Huh. Okay. So I tried to be more subtle about it, but that didn't work out. So I loved my parents very much, but I also kind of hated them for trying to get in my way and trying to, like, get through to me. And I just wasn't going to have it. So my mother did die, and she was surrounded by family, and she was an amazing sort of, she reached out for help. She did everything that people should do when they're dying. She told everybody how much she loved them. She was wonderful. And she forgave me. At the very last minute, I had this horrible change of heart, and I just got into bed with her, and all I could say was, I'm sorry. I couldn't go through the whole, you know, here's what I did. But she knew what I did. She had told me that, you know, I had hurt her feelings. And so I looked at her, and I said, I'm sorry. And she looked at me, and she said, it's okay. And I think she died, like, a day or two later. So at least she forgave me. So that was nice. So let's see. Then I drank quite a bit more after that because it was what made me happy. I mean, I just kind of realized that when I drink and I do other things, I feel happy. And so my friends were kind of like, okay, let's just let her drink for a while. And then they started to get worried. My friends that were my own age started to get worried about me. And so at some point, the different teachers at my school kind of pulled me into their offices and said, you know, we're worried about you. This doesn't seem to be going well. And I just said, oh, no, there was just an isolated incident. You know, I was overserved, et cetera, et cetera. But they basically kind of said, well, we've heard otherwise, so just be careful. And so when it came time for the senior prom of my senior year, they were kind of on the lookout for me, and I sort of knew that because they had told me face-to-face, so I had a clue. But as it turned out, nobody wanted to have the party at their house, and so, again, there wouldn't be drinking if somebody didn't do it, so I said I would do it. I said I would have it at my house. And that night was interesting. I was so afraid that when I was inside the school, I would sober up, so I had to kind of front load, you know? I couldn't eat very much, and I had to drink a lot because I knew there was going to be a couple hours where I didn't have any access to alcohol. And so I remember the guy that I was dating at the time, the boyfriend, would say, like, can you just put that down? And he tried to grab the bottle, and I grabbed it right back and chugged as much as I could and then blacked out. And so I have no recollection of the entire thing, but I did get kicked out and apparently couldn't speak or walk, so that didn't go very well. So let's see, the next morning, I sort of didn't know that I was going to have to reveal this to my dad because my teacher kindly called my older sister to come pick me up. And so my sister the next morning said, like, you know, you're really going to have to tell dad about this. You're in big trouble. And I was kind of like, oh, man, this is a mess. And I don't know if it was a prayer or if it was like a half prayer or whatever. But when I woke up that next morning, I said, something has to change. Something big has to change. I had tried a couple of different things to kind of control it. Like, I had tried, one of my good friends after that Duke trip, she said, why don't you limit yourself to 6 drinks? And I said, okay, that sounded reasonable, and I couldn't do it. At one point, we decided that Maggie could only have one substance in any given night, and that if I just stuck to one thing. But the problem with that was that alcohol always becomes available first, and so I'm not going to say no to that, and then I'm stuck. So that didn't work out. There were a couple other things I tried. I even poured out a half a drink one time. I mean, that's pretty bold, right? But nothing worked. And I was getting a little bit desperate. Like, I can't keep getting in trouble like this and doing things where I end up in different places and with different clothes. And it's just not working. And I was actually getting scared, a little bit scared. So I went in for a meeting with the dean of students at my school and my dad. And they both knew me. The dean of students knew me pretty well. She had kind of taken me under her arm when my mother was sick. And they both cried, and they both were incredibly kind and nice to me and said that they were really worried about me. And I was completely bewildered, and I told them I didn't understand and that they were totally wrong and I didn't have a problem, and it just totally shocked me that they would say this. After all of those things, I just felt like with every bone in my body, I knew they were wrong. But they were being so nice, and they weren't really punishing me. And so I thought, well, I at least owe it to them to try this stupid thing. So they sent me to a guy at the brother school who ended up 12-stepping me. He just kind of gave me a few of those quizzes, and I answered all the questions right. I passed the test. And he said, why don't you go to a meeting? And he told me which meeting to go to. And actually, in retrospect, I'm pretty sure he planted his daughter there, who had gotten sober when she was 15, and she raised her hand and shared at the very first meeting that she's been sober for 5 years and she's 20. And so instantly I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't be too young for this. Look at that. But I still thought I was too young for it. So they had me go to meetings every day for, I think it was 2 weeks until I graduated. That was like an extra little graduation requirement for me. And I did. In the first few meetings, I didn't relate very, very well, but kind of what amazed me was that people accepted me. I thought for sure they would say, like, look at that punk. You know, she's just some kid that got in trouble in high school. She doesn't belong here. She doesn't want to be here. And they didn't say any of that. They were really, really nice to me. And they actually sort of acted like I maybe belong there. And I was a little surprised. But I thought to myself, okay, stay tuned. And obviously the first people that I heard share went way further than I ever went. I was only drinking on weekends. I mean, occasionally I would drink during the week and things like that, but I wasn't a daily drinker. I drank for basically 2.5 years. You know, I didn't have DTs, or I never went into rehab or anything like that. But somehow, some way, I heard my story being told eventually. Within those first 2 weeks, I figured out that I had this thing, and that people had gone further than me, but they started off the exact same way. And that I basically had a choice, that I could accept this gift that was given to me, or I could say no thank you and risk it. And I got scared. I got really scared because I wanted to be happy and have a good life. And I kind of sort of figured out that that was not going to happen if I kept drinking. The guy that I visited at the brother school basically said to me, with your drinking pattern, in high school you do fine because you're with your friends. In college, you're going to wake up in another state, or you're going to wake up pregnant, or you're going to, you know, fail out of school, or all of the above. And I sort of knew he was right, because that's how much I loved drinking. And so I started actually joining up. The guy that I had talked to said, why don't you make a choice? After the 2 weeks, he had me come back, and he said, why don't you choose either stay sober, try and stay sober for the summer, or set a limit on the number of drinks you have. And ironically, he told me to try 6, and I just started laughing. I said that, I already tried that. Let me just try the 0 plan. And he said, good, I'm glad. So it was kind of crazy. I was 17, and I was about to go away to college, and I went to these meetings all summer, and I sort of fell in love with them because the people were so nice to me. And I actually started praying, which I hadn't been praying very much. I was raised Catholic, and I guess I really didn't ever have any major resentment against the church, but I wasn't terribly religious either. I sort of went and counted the minutes till church was over in the good Catholic tradition. So I started praying, and I felt better. And so I worked with this sponsor who was 3 years older than me. She was actually a classmate of my sister's. And They wanted to be with me, these people did. They would hang out with me, and they didn't tell me that I was snotty or annoying or anything. They just, I guess, liked me or something. I don't know. It was kind of amazing. So that's how I got my start. I went off to college. I went to Duke, and I was really scared that I was going to drink. And so I started going to meetings 6 days a week, I want to say. I didn't have a car, so it was kind of hard, but there were a couple on campus, and I got a ride to some meetings. And I liked them. They weren't quite... I loved the meetings in Baltimore where I got sober, so of course I was always trying to compare it. But they kept me sober, and I met, there was like two other students in the entire campus that were sober, and one of them I married, so that worked out. But there was a guy that I kind of called the drug and alcohol counselor to introduce myself and say, I'm really scared I'm going to drink, you know, like, what can I do? And she said, oh, well, why don't you meet this guy, Peter, he got sober last year, and she said, just look out, he's looking for a girlfriend. So I'm like, okay, I'll look out for that. But he was really nice. I actually met him through a friend of a friend anyway. He was at fraternity parties, which for some reason I was going to because I didn't know what else to do. So I would go to these parties and not drink and feel awkward. And then this nice guy, Peter, would talk to me. And he was a senior. But he was just really nice. So we were friends that year, my freshman year. But other than that, I hated Duke and I wanted to leave. So I did. I applied to some other schools. I think I was just going to kind of quit the college thing and go home or something. But actually, I went to visit my sister during the spring break of my freshman year. And she went to this cute little school called Haverford. It was like a Quaker school with like 1,000 people outside of Philadelphia. And I totally loved it. They were so nice. And so I asked if I could apply there. And they said, well, it's past the deadline, but just put an application. So I did, and they accepted me. And so I switched. It was a much better fit. It was like a nerd school, you know. So it worked out for me. And so actually at Haverford was the first time where I actually started to make new friends sober. You know, it was like I sort of naturally gravitated towards people that didn't party quite as much, and they were like this really interesting, fun, nice group of people. So that was really cool. It was like some of the people I still keep in touch with. And so that was great. So I went there, and at some point I decided I did want to be a doctor. My father was a doctor, and I sort of for several years decided that to be spiteful towards him, I didn't want to because that was really cool to be mean. And then I realized I really did probably want to do that, so I started getting ready to apply for medical school. So the other thing that happened at Haverford was that I desperately wanted to be normal and fit in. Even though I wasn't drinking, there were these other people that weren't drinking either, and so I thought, like, maybe if I just don't go to meetings and I don't tell anybody about the past, I'll be normal. And I really wasn't, but they loved me anyway. Let's see, I did college. I had good friends. It was a nerd school. It was great. And I applied for medical school. And actually, that guy, Peter, we had started dating about a week before the end of the school year, my freshman year. And for some crazy reason, we stayed together. It was kind of amazing. We didn't really, like, talk about it ahead of time because when I started dating, there was a week left. But he called me over the summer, and we got together a couple times, and then he would visit me at my new college. So that made me happy. That was nice. I was a little bit scared, actually, to go back to the meetings because I thought they would tell me I couldn't see this guy. I don't know if there really is a rule that you're not supposed to date in your first year, but I knew that I wasn't quite a year sober yet when we started dating, so I sort of felt like, well, I can't go to meetings or get a sponsor because I really love this guy. And it turns out that was wrong, and I could have gone to meetings and had a sponsor. That would have been okay, too. But anyway, I applied to medical school, and Peter wanted to be in Georgia. He was in the Navy at that time. He had graduated, and he was in a submarine officer, and he was down in Georgia. And so I applied for Emory to see if I could get in somewhere a little closer to him. And I did, and they offered to pay for my tuition. So I said, yes, please, thank you. And I started medical school, and I still wasn't going to meetings. Since my first year of sobriety, I really didn't go to too many meetings because I just desperately wanted to fit in. And so, let's see, first year of medical school, didn't love it, sort of unpleasant in general, but I did fine. Peter and I got married after the first year of medical school, and then he had to go out on a sub again, so I kind of, like, lost him for a while. But that's fine, because all I did was study anyway. Second year of medical school, we had this unit on alcoholism and drug addictions, and they had us go to a meeting, and I thought, well, that's a good idea. I should go to a meeting. So I did, and I started going back. And it was nice. I made new AA friends, and I met people, and even though I had been a terrible AA for like 3 years or 4 years, they didn't mind at all, and they accepted me back with loving arms, and that sort of characterized my history with AA, which is that you don't have to be an overachiever to fit in here. you can kind of, like, you know, not be so great at it, and it's fine. So that was nice. Let's see. I had still wanted to have a bunch of kids, so Peter said he was great with that, and so we decided we'd have a ton of kids, And I think we decided on 5. So we had to get started. Because, you know, if I wanted all 5 before I was 35. And so we started having babies, and I was in medical school, and I was really busy. And so I just didn't have time to go to the meetings, even though I liked them. I went until my first son was like a year, maybe 2. But then after that, I was basically at school 100, 120 hours a week, and so there was just no way. And so being the sort of it's all or nothing person that I am, instead of going back when I had an easier rotation, I just dropped it for a while. So let's see. I had Jackson when I was in medical school. He's 13 now. He was like this crazy colicky baby. And I stayed home with him for 4 months, I think. And I knew after the end of that 4 months that I would never be a stay-at-home mother. And I ran back to medical school. And let's see. So I finished up medical school. And this is funny. I'm really stubborn. I'm told some other alcoholics are, too. When I was in medical school, they told me that in order to be a dermatologist, you had to get the best grades in your class and you had to walk on water. And I knew I didn't do those two things, but I decided I was going to do that. I was like, yeah, if you tell me I can't do it, I'm doing it. So I actually had to take a year off and do some research, but I did eventually decide to become a dermatologist because they told me I couldn't, haha. So I did it. Let's see. So I finished medical school, and I started with residency. I matched at Emory, so I stayed in town for that. I had another baby when I was an intern, which people told me I couldn't do also, yet another motivator for me to do that because I thought that would be cool. She wasn't as colicky, so that was nice. And I'm trying to think when I started getting back into the meetings again. I was happy and I was free, and I was kind of like amazed that I was having this life that was unfolding in front of me that I knew almost got taken away from me. And so I knew all along that AA had been a ticket for me, that it gave me my future, basically. It gave me the future that I wanted, and I got it. And so, let's see, I became a dermatologist, I did my residency, I had a couple more babies, and then I finished, let's see, I took my boards, I studied for like 2 years for those stupid things, and I had another one like maybe 6 weeks after my boards, and so by now we're at 4. And, well, I'm at 5 really now, but I was at 4 then, so I kept going. So let's see, I finished with my residency, I took my boards, and I took a job, and this is kind of a turning point. I had always thought I would be this nerdy person that would stay in school forever, and all of a sudden I knew I actually wanted to be normal and not go the path that my dad took, and I just wanted to be like a worker among workers, you know? Like, I just wanted to take a job and do my thing and to be have some free time. And so I took this job with Kaiser, who I work for now, and it's been awesome. And so, let's see, I had one more baby, and then I finally realized, like, you know, I've got to get back to those meetings. It's been, like, 10 years. And it had always been on my list of things to do, and I always knew I'd be better off if I went. And there were definitely things that happened that I think reflected not being spiritually healthy. One of the ones that was kind of funnier that I didn't realize at the time was when I was a resident, I was getting feedback. We had to go in and get our evaluations, like, every year, every 6 months, and I got so angry when people gave me negative evaluations, so angry that I actually asked my program director if I could please never hear about my evaluations again, if I could just have an exception. Everybody else had to hear about them, but I wanted just a sealed envelope, and I was just going to burn it in the fireplace, and I didn't understand why he didn't want me to do that. I just didn't understand why he couldn't make an exception for me, because I said, well, I'm trying as hard as I can anyway, so if it's good, it doesn't really matter. I'm already trying hard, and if it's bad, what's it going to help? So anyway, terminal uniqueness had set in, and I knew I had to go back. And it was funny, too, because for a long time I knew that there were benefits to this program beyond staying sober, and I wanted those benefits. I wanted the fellowship. I wanted the spiritual sort of awakening. I wanted to feel better. But what actually got me back was, after being away for a long time, I had this dream where I was walking up to a house, and I saw a glass of wine sitting on the stone steps. There was nothing else to this dream. And I walked up, and I picked it up, and I drank it in one sip. And I put it down. And that was it. That was the whole dream. And I woke up kind of in a sweat, and I had to ask my husband, like, have I gone out? What's happened? Because I really thought I had had a drink. And he assured me that I hadn't, but I knew that, to me anyway, that was a message from my higher power that I had to get back to meetings. And I did that day. I went back, and I think it was maybe 2 years ago, maybe a year and a half. I don't know what it was, but it was awesome again. I met such great people, but it had been so long that I didn't even realize anymore that you're supposed to get a sponsor and work the steps and that kind of thing. So I went to this meeting called Fifth Tradition, and they were really heavy into working the steps and getting a sponsor at that group, and I was kind of like, oh my gosh, these people are wild. Like, everybody stands up when they're ready to be your sponsor, and like half the room stood up, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. And so I went to that meeting a few more times, not really knowing what my plan was, but I ended up bumping into someone who offered to be my sponsor. She kind of said, like, what's your deal? You know, like, how long do you have, and do you have a sponsor? And I said, well, mine died. Which is a pretty good excuse because she did die, but I never got another one. And she said, well, I sponsor women, and she had 1 year. And I said, great, let's do it. You know, she said, I'm trying to think of women that have a lot of time that could sponsor you. And then she added, well, I mean, if you want, I could do it. And I'm like, yes, thank you. And so she's been my sponsor ever since. We've worked the steps together, and I have gotten a newfound sense of a spiritual awakening and fellowship and friends. I wanted friends, and I got friends. You know, it was really cool. Friends who I like to hang out with, who understood me. Like I said, I had met friends before who didn't drink very much, and that was all good and well, but there's something a little different and more special about the bond that I have with people in these rooms, even though I only drank for a few years. For a long time, I hid my book in this cabinet. I used to have a bunch of copies of the book, and I would tell everybody if they wanted to know, and then over time, I got more and more sort of subtle about it, and I hid this book in one cabinet, and I never, ever said anything about it. And I kind of finally realized that I was pretending like it wasn't true, and that if I fake like it wasn't true, it would go away, and it didn't go away. So got back into going to meetings, started working the steps with this awesome sponsor who said things like, I want you to call me every day. And I said, why? You know, like, why do you want to talk to me? And she's like, just, let's just talk. And we just talked about how our day went, and we basically, after the first few months, became best friends. And I started to get it. You know, she said, call other women. And I was kind of like, well, I have friends as it is, and this is really awkward for me. She said, just do it. Just try it. And I did, and I've made really good friends, and it's just been amazing. So for me, my drinking story was really short compared to other people, and yet somehow I identified and I knew that I had those same feelings of I was desperate to not keep doing what I was doing, but I couldn't figure out a way to get out of it. I couldn't. And I just knew. I knew something major had to change. I had no idea it was going to be that big of a change. It's actually funny. I've been sober long enough now that lots of people know me without ever knowing the drinking part. And even my dad, who's the one that got me into treatment, I was on the phone with him the other day, and he said something about, oh, you know, the whole time you were a kid, you were compulsive about always following all the rules. And I sort of chuckled and waited for the until, you know, like, and he didn't say it. And I said, but Dad, and he's like, well, then there was a drinking part, but beyond that. And it was funny because that was like 2.5 years, the last 2.5 years of high school, and it was a disaster for all of us. And he sort of blocked it out because in his sweet way, he doesn't want to think of me that way. You know, he wants to think of me without that. And I sort of love him for that because I really messed with him for a long time. So my family has forgiven me. My sister and my dad, I'm really close with. It took me a couple years to get back to where I felt close to them, but I'm really close with them. I have an amazing husband. He's unbelievable. He lets me. I work a little more than he does. He works, but he doesn't work as much as me. So he does a lot more of the drop-off and pick-up. He drives a minivan. I mean, it's like amazing, right? So I have 5 kids who I love more than anything in the world. And they're definitely wild, and I definitely worry. The oldest is 13, and he may have a future in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. We'll have to see. But anyway, I never thought I would get all the things that I dreamed about, and I got every single one of them and more. And 100%, it's from this program and from the higher power that I got in touch with through this program. And I guess I was trying to think of how to explain away the fact that I stayed away for a while and came back, and I've always felt guilty about that. But the first time I came back, I heard a speaker talking about how he had been sober 25 years and he relapsed. And And so I guess what I figured out was that I was a relapse waiting to happen, and I just didn't, it didn't happen yet. And so that I can kind of understand. I think that dream was my signal that I was about to have a relapse because I had no defense against the first drink. There was no argument in my mind. I also had realized at some point that when there was somebody else who had a drinking problem, my heart wanted me to reach out and help them, but I couldn't help them. You know, I didn't know of any meetings, and I didn't know people, and I realized that, but that part of my job is to be of service to others, and part of that is to help people who have a drinking problem if they need the help, and that I couldn't do that, so I belonged back at meetings. So for me and for others, I went back, and it's been totally amazing, and I'm incredibly thankful every single day. I pray every morning and every night, thanking God and asking for help, and I think that's it.
Thank you, Maggie. Powerful story. Thank you for being here.
First I slip, and then I crib to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. Look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that sets me free. Where the promises are.